you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, and make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Speak Out with Tim Wise. We are now into August and coming to the end of what I announced several weeks back would be sort of a vacation period for myself and for the program, taking a little time off, not doing any live interviews. I was trying to spend some time with family, take a vacation, a lot of other people who I wanted to interview also taking a bit of a break, but now going to try to pick things up a little bit today. Wanted to spend some time talking about what I know is going to become, as it has been for several years now, on campus as schools start back here in the next couple of weeks, this issue of free speech, and particularly as it relates to the college campus, because you can, you know, certainly imagine that as school starts back, we're going to have all these right-wingers who have really figured out how to portray themselves as the ultimate victims. It's fascinating, right, how the right wing portrays itself as disempowered victims in an era where they control the presidency, they control the Congress, both houses, they control the Supreme Court, they control every lever of power, but they consider themselves victims because people make fun of them every now and then. So it's fascinating. It's the same people that say that the left and black people and women and gays and lesbians and bisexual, transgendered folks and poor people shouldn't play victims, but they play victim better than anyone. And the way they do it is talking about how nobody will let them speak. They'll talk about on the college campus, my God, they won't let right-wing conservative speakers speak, and the professors make fun of us and shout us down in class and punish us for expressing our opinions. I want to talk a little bit about that. First of all, we'll debunk some of that here in a second, but I want to talk about it because I know that stuff is going to bubble up again as the school year starts. In order to do that, I want to process with you sort of what free speech is and what it isn't, both in terms of sort of conceptually, but also the legal framework as it currently exists. And I want to do this in particular because there's a lot of misunderstanding. And the reason I want to do this now is, you know, last week, there was a controversy starting to really bubble up over at YouTube and also Facebook, Spotify, and iTunes about what to do with Alex Jones, the hateful host of the InfoWars program with millions of listeners and followers. This is a guy who says, you know, Sandy Hook was a hoax. All the mass shootings are just hoaxes. They're all crisis actors, blah, blah, blah. All this bullshit that these conspiracy-addled fools, the same people that believe the QAnon conspiracy over on Reddit and 4chan, oh, yeah, there's this global pedophile ring and Donald Trump's about to expose Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and everybody who's ever been president for having been part of this globalist sex slave ring with children. This is the kind of stuff that woefully under-medicated people like Roseanne Barr, for instance, actually believe. And Alex Jones is probably the biggest of the conspiracy trolls out there, and he has millions of followers. Well, this week, YouTube, Facebook, Spotify, and iTunes all decided to either remove parts of his content, some of the more offending and defensive programs on his show, or just to ban him altogether. I think YouTube now has pulled down his channel altogether. Facebook has eliminated his page altogether. And as a result of the Alex Jones and InfoWars ban, you know, his fans and he himself are crying, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. And this really just goes to show how little people understand the concept of free speech and free expression, what it means and what it doesn't mean. So before I get into the issue as it relates to the college campus, I'm going to do a few things first. The first thing I want to do is talk about what free speech is not. Then I want to talk about what free speech is currently in terms of the legal jurisprudence on this issue. And then I want to spend a second talking about why I think some of the arguments made by the free speech absolutist, the ACLU and others, are naive and wrong, before I then close by talking about what I think colleges can do and why I think they should be able to do it and how they might be able to do it. And I'm a staunch supporter of free speech and free expression as somebody who makes my living, for God's sake, sharing my opinion as an educator. Obviously, I have an interest in being able to express my views freely and other people being able to express theirs. I'm not a fan of restricting freedom of speech. What I do believe, however, is that we have to have a much more nuanced understanding of this subject philosophically, ideologically, and constitutionally if we are going to make freedom of speech a substantive reality, not just a procedural reality, but a substantive reality. And I'll explain what I mean in just a second. But first, let's talk a little bit about what free speech is not. If you look at the First Amendment, the words are very simple. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Those are 10 words. There are no others in the Constitution about the issue of free expression. Now, they're not necessarily clear as to what speech exactly is allowed and disallowed. I'll talk about that in a few minutes in terms of what the courts have said. But it is certainly clear as to which entities, what types of entities are prohibited from disallowing speech. The First Amendment is a prohibition against government imposition on the freedom of speech. And yet it has become common as of late for a lot of people to say that Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and Spotify now in the wake of the Alex Jones ban are somehow violating the free speech of conservatives by either removing them from their platforms altogether for certain things that they've said or on a more limited level using algorithms that somehow throttle their reach and limit how many people can see their content, or that, for instance, the refusal of web servers to continue to play host to the Daily Stormer, which is probably the most prominent neo-Nazi site on the web, and a decision that forced Andrew Anglin, who hosts that site, to go onto the dark web because he couldn't find a server to continue to host him, that somehow that is a restriction of Andrew Anglin's free expression. All of this because apparently people think that their right to say whatever the hell comes into their head obligates other people to open up their online homes for the dissemination of that nonsense, or they believe that their right to spew hatred entitles them to the ears of other people, or that they believe they're entitled to megabytes of bandwidth on someone else's website or an audience that was purchased with someone else's money. And if you make any attempt to limit the reach of their commentary, even if you're doing it on your own website, on your own social media page, somehow you are a leftist authoritarian. In fact, sometimes even people who push back on hateful speech and call it hateful, simply calling racism racism, for instance, gets you labeled as a censor, right? Even just calling out hateful speech, people will criticize that. They'll say, well, you know, if you publicly condemn a person's bigotry, that's censorship. It doesn't respect the right of the bigot to be a bigot, as if somehow your right to free speech means the right to consequence free speech. The idea that racists have a right to be racist and you don't have a right to talk back to them, but that's ridiculous, right? If you have a right to say racist shit, I got a right to call you a racist, and you can let the chips fall where they may. That's what free speech suggests. Free speech does the following, and this is, again, going back to the words in the Constitution. Free speech entitles you to a couple of things. It entitles you to remain unjailed, untortured, and alive, even when you demonstrate your ignorance. Other than that, pretty much nothing. Here's what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean anyone is obligated to provide you with the means for getting heard. No one owes you a microphone. No one owes you column inches in their newspaper. No one owes you a podium at their college. I'll get to that in just a little bit. So you should feel free to print your own newsletter, stand on a corner, pontificate to your heart's delight about any subject you choose, knock yourself out sending around stupid chain emails that try to prove the moon landing was fake, or, you know, that the planes we all saw fly into the Twin Towers were just 3D holograms, or that vaccines cause autism and humans rode on the backs of dinosaurs, or whatever. But just don't insist that a radio station or a writer's syndication service or a publishing house has to give you a contract to spread that bullshit, or that when they opt not to, that you've somehow been a victim. Free speech also doesn't protect you from losing your job. Unless you have a specifically negotiated union contract that requires a very clear performance-based reason for termination, your First Amendment rights don't mean very much when it comes to your place of employment. And even if you have a union contract, like if you're a police officer or a teacher, racist speech, for instance, could very easily, and I think should, result in you losing your job, because a case could be made that those kinds of biases would very likely impact your ability to perform your job equitably in those positions, thereby violating the rights of others, such as the equal protection rights that are guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. And so when those rights come into conflict, your right to express yourself in a hateful way in those kinds of sensitive positions in particular could very easily be trumped by the equal protection rights of others within a particular type of setting, like an educational setting or a law enforcement setting. And that could end up trumping, no pun intended, whatever protections you may have in the union contract. In general, when you are in the workplace, free speech is not really a thing. And it ought to be obvious, right? After all, you can't insult your boss and expect to keep getting a check from them. When it comes to political speech, even though it would be stupid, I think, for a boss to say, I'm only hiring Democrats or I'm only hiring Republicans, because after all, they would then, you know, sort of cut out half of the potential employee base, usually not a good move when you're trying to run a business, but they could do it. If you post racist stuff on your Facebook page, if you get videotaped calling police on black people for no good reason, you can, and I think should be, fired. And you're not a victim of anything but your own behavior, your own stupidity when you do it. And morally, look, do we really think that, let's say, a boss who was Jewish should be obligated to keep, some Nazi on the payroll if he discovered or she discovered that one of their employees was a Nazi? Are they obligated to keep them on there for the sake of liberty and free speech? And, you know, I think the answer pretty obviously no. And if Nazis can't find jobs because no one wants to hire them, that's too damn bad. You don't have to be a Nazi. You chose to be one. And if nobody wants to hire you because they find that viewpoint horrific, then too bad. Get together with some of your master race buddies, you know, in between chugging beer, posting on 4chan and asking your mom to make you another hot pocket in the microwave, and start your own damn business if you don't like it. But this is the problem. We got a lot of people running around thinking that free speech means they have the right to say whatever they want, whenever they want, wherever they want, and suffer no consequence at all. And that's not true. Now let's talk about what it is. Let's be clear. No one in their right mind actually believes that there can be no limits on free speech. Even the people I'm calling free speech absolutist or First Amendment absolutist don't really believe that. How do we know? Because even they tend to accept the limits that the courts have imposed. The idea that there can be no limits is just not what the law says. Right now, the law says that certain things are not allowed. Fighting words are not allowed. Defamation is certainly not allowed. Things like libel and slander are not allowed. Child pornography, not allowed. Perjury is a form of speech, but you can't do it legally. Blackmail is a speech act, but you can't do it. Any incitement to imminent lawless action is not allowed. True threats, person-to-person direct threats that are considered to be credible, those are not allowed. Solicitations to commit crimes. So even free speech absolutists will usually acknowledge, yeah, there are some speech acts that we do not allow because there's such an intense public interest in prohibiting certain things. And then what that means is, if we are willing to say certain speech won't be allowed, then we ought to have the question as to why not other things in that category. If we can, for instance, say no defamation, or if we can say no incitement to imminent lawless action or no fighting words, the question becomes, well, why doesn't racist speech, sexist speech, Islamophobic speech fall under some of those categories? I'm not saying that it should or shouldn't, does or doesn't. I'm just saying those are legitimate questions. If I'm not allowed to defame you individually, why am I allowed to defame your entire group as biologically inferior or as, you know, involved in some global conspiracy to control the world? We ought to have these conversations because we already have the categories that are carved out. So looking specifically at the existing case law on this, The courts have said that speech can be limited, but the basis for the limitation really cannot be the content or viewpoint of the speech in isolation alone. The context within which the content is delivered, the manner, the time, the place, the tone in which it is delivered, all of that can potentially fall outside the boundaries of constitutional protection because it can amount to fighting words, it can amount to harassment, it can amount to an act of intimidation, it can amount to a true threat. Obviously, these are subjective categories, but that is the way the court is generally found. If the only thing at issue is the expression of a particular viewpoint which somebody finds offensive, that probably isn't going to be enough. If, however, it is directed specifically at a group of people or someone like in a face-to-face kind of way, it could very well be prohibited or punished and fall outside the boundaries of free speech protections because it would rise to the level of intimidation, harassment, etc. So, you know, when you think about it in terms of the college campus, just to give you, you know, two scenarios, if you imagine, for instance, a college classroom discussion where a student in the class says something that is really quite racist, you know, not like a slur or something, but I mean, just like, you know, saying, oh, you know, I think that on average, black people are less intelligent than white people. And maybe he bust out some bell curve bullshit or maybe just some crap he read online from some white supremacist website the night before. The odds are incredibly good that that student cannot be punished under existing law and really, frankly, you know, shouldn't be. Those kinds of statements in a class, as racist and offensive as they are rebuttable. It is the job of the professor in that instant, who is a scholar and academic, at least in theory, to shut that shit down, right? The scholar has the right to squash nonsense. That's what their job is to dispense wisdom, which your typical 18 and 19-year-old college student, no offense to those listening to this who are that, doesn't have yet. That's why they're in college. So the professor's job is to shut that shit down. It is not the job of the school to expel or to suspend or to punish that person for saying bullshit in a classroom. On the other hand, if that same student were going up to particular black people on the campus and saying, you don't belong here, black people are unintelligent, you should be removed from the school, white people are superior, blah, 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 that could very easily be punished because that would amount to an act of intimidation. That would amount to an act of harassment. You know, graffiti on a dorm room door would not only amount to potentially criminal trespass and vandalism, but would also be, you know, an act of intimidation or an act of harassment. The argument is at the court level that the content and the viewpoint alone are not enough. A paradigmatic example of this in the legal system, there were two cases that were decided over the course of an 11-year period by functionally the very same Supreme Court, and they seem to be contradictory, but it sort of makes the point I'm trying to make. In 1992, there was a case involving a cross burning in St. Paul, Minnesota, and under the existing law in St. Paul, the perpetrators, the white men who burned this cross on the lawn of a black family, were arrested under and they were prosecuted under a law in St. Paul that prohibited any kind of an act that was intended to intimidate or provoke fear, anger, etc., on the basis of race, ethnicity, nationality, etc. And the Supreme Court ultimately held that that law was unconstitutional and it was a violation of free speech, not because they were saying it was okay to burn a cross on someone's lawn. That wasn't actually what they were saying. What they were saying was prohibiting an act that is clearly about intimidation and provoking fear and anger, but only if it's about race or ethnicity, et cetera, makes it a viewpoint-based, content-based restriction. Therefore, that's unconstitutional. What they were saying is St. Paul could have prosecuted under different laws, could have prosecuted under trespassing, could have prosecuted under malicious harassment, could have prosecuted under a whole host of other things. But to prosecute only on the basis of the content of the intimidating act was not constitutional. Now, 11 years later, in a case out of Virginia, which involved a cross burning, the court, including Justice Scalia, who was in the majority in the first case and said that that particular law was unconstitutional, agreed in the second case out of Virginia that the prohibition on cross-burning there was legitimate if it could be shown that the act of the cross-burning was intended to intimidate. The one problem they had with the law was that under the way the law was written in Virginia, this part they struck down. The Virginia law said that an act like a cross-burning would be considered prima facie evidence of intimidation. In other words, it would be presumed an act of intimidation until proven otherwise. The problem with that, the court said, was that if you're going to allow this act to be presumed an act of intimidation, which of course, I mean, it sounds sort of common sense to you and me probably, but they said to write that into the law is unconstitutional because in effect that flips the burden of proof and the presumption of innocence in any criminal case, right? So if I go out and burn a cross and you presume that that's evidence of intimidation and you have a law that says intimidation is illegal, now I am presumed guilty guilty, and that flips the due process rights that I have under other constitutional amendments. And so you can't have that. But what they said is, as long as you can show that it was an act of intimidation, you are able to punish that. You're essentially punishing it not because of the content alone. You are punishing it because you can demonstrate it was intended as an act of intimidation. And of course, let's be honest, most acts like burning a cross or like racist graffiti or anything that blatant, it isn't real hard to prove that it was intended as an act of intimidation. And of course, that kind of logic would extend not only in the cross burning type incident, you know, on the edge of town or in a cornfield or whatever, but it would also apply on a college campus. So that's sort of where the law stands right now. But putting aside the law for a second, let's just talk about this philosophically and ideologically, because whatever the law says at a given moment obviously does not tell us what the law should say or what it could say 5 years from now, 10, 20 years from now. So let's have the conversation at a philosophical level. And we know that philosophically, there are some very common arguments that one will hear, both in favor of sort of a hands-off free speech absolutist position and also the speech restrictionist, particularly around hate speech limitations position. And I want to sort of look at those in turn. I want to suggest that the premises of the free speech absolutist are sort of classical liberal notions, right? That free and unfettered exchange in the marketplace of ideas will sort of inevitably result in the best of those ideas winning out, and that maximizing free expression is instrumental in the larger what we call search for truth. But, you know, both of those things sound very nice, that the best ideas win, or that, you know, maximum free expression helps us find truth. But it's really interesting, isn't it, how rarely the people who make those arguments, which again are these classical liberal maxims, how rarely they actually present evidence to demonstrate that they're true. Do the best ideas, for instance, really win out in the marketplace of ideas? First of all, you know, who gets to define what the best ideas are? I mean, typically we think of the marketplace of ideas. If we think about a market, right, the best ideas in a market are like the best products in a market. They're just the ones that most people buy. So I guess we could say that the idea behind the best ideas win out is that the most popular ideas, the ones that most people believe in, will win out. But is that really true? And even if it is true, you know, do we want to just assume a majoritarian position that says, well, whatever the majority agrees with or believes must automatically be the best thing? I mean, if that's going to be the standard, then, you know, I guess slavery was the best idea. It won out for a very, very long time. Segregation was the best idea. It won out for a very long time. You know, not letting women vote must have been the best idea because it won out for a very long time, right? These things are always changing. And so the idea that the best ideas win, I mean, maybe in the long run they do because we've ended race-based chattel slavery and women have the right to vote. We've had all this progress, but it took a very long time to get there. So even if you argue the best ideas win out in the end and that evil is trumped and bad ideas fall, it can take generations. It can take centuries. It can take incredibly long periods. And like John Maynard Keynes said, you know, in the end, we're all dead. So what happens in the long run isn't always that helpful. But back to the point, do the best ideas win out in a free and unfettered marketplace of ideas? Well, if so, then ask yourself the question, is Donald Trump as president of the United States an example of a best idea winning, or even the most popular one? Again, if we're going to define best in a marketplace as the one that catches on and has the most popularity, is Donald Trump as president an example of a best idea under a market analysis? Well, of course not. The election results indicate that. He lost by 3 million votes, so the majority of people didn't in fact support him. Polls ever since have suggested the majority of Americans do not support him now. And yet he is president anyway. Why? Not because the best ideas went out, but because we have a particular political structure in our American electoral system that intervenes in the political marketplace of ideas and causes disproportionate power to be centered in certain states via, for instance, the Electoral College. In other words, there is no real market. To speak of free speech in this abstract way as this force that allows the best thinking to rise to the top and carry the day is to conceive of markets as truly open. These places where people have access to full information and they have the time to weigh all their options, where there are no obstacles, no rules, no regulations, no systemic barriers existing that might skew the outcomes of otherwise rational deliberation. But as the Trump election indicates, there are structures, in fact, that get in the way of the free and open working of the so-called marketplace of ideas. So the ideas that end up carrying the day are not necessarily the best. as determined by the support that they're able to command in the market. They are the ideas supported by the most powerful. Just as economic markets favor those who have the most money, political markets favor not only financial power, but the power of electors in smaller states whose population's ideologies might be in the minority nationwide, but who end up having an outsized influence on the Electoral College in presidential races and in the Senate, where they end up having two people in the Senate to represent them just as much as states who have 20 times their population will. We have a system that skews the market. These arguments assume that the marketplace of ideas is a fair and equitable marketplace. But how is the marketplace of ideas any different from any other market? How is it any different from the healthcare market or the educational market or the housing market, all of which, I beg to remind you, liberals believe in regulating? And even a lot of conservatives believe in, not like a pure libertarian, you know, but even a lot of conservatives believe, hey, we got to have some regulations in order to make this market work. People on the right might believe in far fewer than people on the left, but only like really hardcore libertarians want pure deregulation. Your average person thinks that's nonsense. We understand you've got to have certain regulations on food quality and medicine quality, because if you don't, then those markets always tilt toward the more powerful. What about the idea that this helps us with the search for truth? Well, in a way, that's true. Obviously, having exposure to different ideas can help us to search for truth. But obviously, if you have ideas being propagated that are fundamentally false and disproven within the realm of scholarship, having those get an equal hearing on par with scholarship that has been verified through social science methods and scientific methods doesn't really help us search for truth. It actually muddies the truth, right? If we were to require, and I'm going to come back to this example, but I just want to use it here. If we were to require geology departments at colleges and universities to hire young earth creationists, people who believe because the Bible suggested that the world is between 6 and 10,000 years old, or if high schools were required to teach creation science, quote unquote, creationism side by side with evolution, even though one has withstood the test of the scientific method and the other has not, if schools had to teach that as a matter of equal time or balance, that really wouldn't help us search for truth. We have a way to search for truth. It's called the scientific method or the social science method. And it's not perfect because things change. We learn new knowledge. We're learning new things about the human genome every day. But in general, we can use the scientific method to make really good theories about why the world works the way that it does. And if your ideology is non-falsifiable, that is to say, there's no test that I can run that could possibly falsify it in your mind, which is what creationists are guilty of, right? I can't falsify your faith because it's based on faith. That's the point. It's not scientific. You believe it because the Bible tells you so. There's no way that I can falsify what your pastor told you because you have this faith. And I'm not trying to mock your faith, by the way. That's fine if you want to believe something. But if it's not falsifiable, it's not science, and it does not deserve to be in a science classroom. And if you insist on it being there, you are not helping the search for truth. So the idea that the more ideas we have to hear, the more likely we are to arrive at truth is not always true at all. It can actually make doing that harder. We have a method for doing it. It's called science and or social science, and that ought to be the standard. We don't simply respond to those kinds of situations by arguing what these liberals argue for when it comes to speech, right? When they say things like the answer to bad speech is good speech, let's try a corollary to that. Would it make any damn sense at all to say, well, you know, the answer to bad landlords is we just need more good landlords? What? Like if a landlord is screwing tenants, the answer is not just to get some more good landlords. The answer is you punish the bad landlord. You do something to the bad landlord. Or think about that. Well, the answer to bad medicine is just more good medicine. What? No, the answer to bad medicine might be, hey, let's get some good medicine, but surely it also means we have to regulate the market for medicine. Why do we assume the marketplace of ideas is different than these other markets? And if it's not different, then this laissez-faire attitude, this idea that we can't have any regulations whatsoever, is inherently ridiculous because it produces inequality, and the effect of that, by virtue of skewing the market, like all these other markets, toward the rich, skewing the market, like all these other markets, toward people with more power, be it economic power, be it political power, a combination of the two, what that ends up doing is it reduces the net amount of substantive free speech. That's the important distinction. A lot of times, the free speech absolutist or the purist only look at free speech in the abstract as this sort of programmatic or procedural thing. rather than a substantive thing. But if you think of free speech as a substantive thing, then you have to look at the power dynamics behind it. And a good example, the ACLU is in a debate about this right now, ever since Charlottesville last year, because there were people within the ACLU that said, hey, we need to stop defending these right-wing neo-Nazi militia types who show up at their rallies with guns, because there are people who would argue we have to defend them and we must stand up for their free speech rights. And there are other people in the organization who were saying, listen, the problem with that argument is if you show up to a rally with weapons, you're actually shutting down free speech on the other side because it's intimidating. People don't want to come challenge you for fear of violence. So now their free speech is suppressed, even as yours is maximized, or they do come out, but they come out with their own weapons. And then we end up with violence as opposed to speech. So instead of saying, you know, the answer to racist armed speech is just come out and, I don't know, chant beautiful Christian hymns at them or something. That's an incredibly large burden to put on marginalized peoples to come out and confront armed gangs of right-wing Nazis. So there are people within the free speech community who I think rightly so are saying, look, we got to have a much broader understanding of free speech. Free speech needs to be looked at like break it down into units, right? And the goal of free speech advocates ought to be let's maximize the overall units of speech in a society. That seems reasonable. We want to maximize the overall units of speech. But if you allow certain people to speak unfettered with weapons and threatening and intimidating people, then you're actually reducing the net amount of speech units in the society because you're shutting down people on the other side. That seems to me a very reasonable conclusion. And if that's reasonable, then why can't we think about the power dynamics in other areas, whether that's campaign finance or whether that is intimidating people on a college campus with racist invective or bringing right-wing speakers who were going to out trans students or who were going to out undocumented students, right? Which is the kind of stuff Milo Yiannopoulos, you know, did when he was on his lecture tour. He was mocking a trans student at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee while that student was in the audience, thereby creating a really hostile environment for a particular person, not simply getting up and talking about trans issues in a general sense, but talking about a particular person. How in the world can we not regulate that on the basis of saying that that's going to shut down the speech of that student? That is going to intimidate that student to such a, you think that student's going to respond to Milo in that moment by standing up and saying, how dare you do this to me? Are you kidding? And is that the cost of free speech? Is that someone who's louder and stronger and has power behind them and more money to be on a lecture circuit gets to intimidate a 19 or 20-year-old student sitting in a lecture hall? And we're going to call that balance? How is that any different from showing up with weapons? In both cases, there's a power differential that has to be considered. Now, this brings me to the issue that I really wanted to talk about specifically as it relates to free speech, and that is the college campus and this controversy over the last year to 2 years or so about outside speakers on college campuses and who ought to be speaking and who ought not be, and should schools be able to restrict access and keep certain speakers from speaking. To hear the right wing, as I said before, talk about it, they would have you believe that conservatives just don't get a hearing any longer. And there has certainly been some controversy about certain speakers. Richard Spencer and the white nationalist folks, who I didn't know conservatives wanted to necessarily make common cause with, but I suppose maybe they do. There has certainly been some debate over whether neo-Nazis and overt white nationalists who believe in the creation of a white ethnostate ought to be given space. And before we get into what schools ought to be able to do and this whole debate about outside speakers and all of that, let's at least get some facts clear up front, because there is a hell of a lot of misunderstanding on this. This whole notion that the right wing wants to weave, this whole story, this narrative, that they are suppressed and nobody will listen to them speak. There's actually factual information to rebut all of this. So let's start with that. Before we get into the philosophical conversation, there is new data from Georgetown University's Free Speech Project. And what that data suggests is that the so-called crisis of free speech on campus is pretty overblown. There have been very few incidents of speech being suppressed in any way on college campuses, and very limited evidence that conservatives in particular are being unfairly targeted. The Free Speech Project at Georgetown, according to this research, which has looked at the last several years, has found a little more than 90 incidents since 2016 that fit the criteria for someone's free speech rights being threatened. And out of those 90 cases, about two-thirds of those have taken place on college campuses. And those incidents are everything from, yes, a speaker being uninvited to a faculty member being fired over, you know, allegedly offensive comments. In one case, there was a student-run play that was canceled over concerns that it would offend certain students. You ought to just look at these numbers, though, and just just think about that. There are over 4,500 colleges and universities in this country. So the fact that out of 4,500 plus colleges, you had about 60 incidents over the last 2 years in which we could argue free speech may have been suppressed means that even if every single one of those cases is an absolutely unfair travesty of justice, it certainly does not mean that we have a free speech crisis on campus. Secondly, when you look at the actual pattern in the data, it is very different than what the conservative folks are saying about how their views are being suppressed. Most of the incidents where presumably, you know, conservative speech was being interrupted or squelched, involved just a few people in particular, the aforementioned Milo Yiannopoulos or Ben Shapiro, Charles Murray, the co-author of The Bell Curve, and Ann Coulter. That was the overwhelming number. So it wasn't like conservative speakers writ large are not being allowed to come speak. There were four particular people, and in most of the cases, the concerns about those people had to do with the manner and the style, the approach that they take, not the fact that they are conservative. For Milo, it was the fear that he was going to, as I said before, out particular students, mock particular students. That's what he does. His whole shtick is performance art. He stands up and says, feminism is cancer. That's not an intellectual argument. Being carried into an event on a throne where he then stands up behind a podium and basically makes fun of trans folks. Ann Coulter, someone who thinks that, you know, saying the 9/11 hijackers' biggest mistake was not flying their planes into the New York Times building. She considers that intellectual commentary. Imagine that a respectable academic institution committed to scholarship might think that that kind of bullshit doesn't quite clear the hurdle of intellectual conversation. Same thing with someone like Charles Murray, who may be a little more erudite than Milo, but nonetheless, whose pseudoscience that he put out in The Bell Curve has been roundly criticized by people in the actual fields of genetics and biology, neither of which Charles Murray has any background in at all, which is one of the reasons he didn't try and submit that garbage to an academic or scholarly journal, because it would have been savaged, and it has been savaged by people who actually study that. So imagine that a school might say, hey, look, you can be a conservative or a libertarian, which is what I think Murray considers himself to be, but if you're going to peddle pseudoscience, which has been roundly rejected by the people in the fields on this campus where you're asking to speak, then we have a right as a scholarly institution to say, yeah, not you. The idea that there is this huge crackdown on conservative speakers just isn't true. These are a handful of people whose style and particular approach has been criticized. And then when you look at the actual incidents, looking at that Georgetown data, what's interesting is that out of the 60 or so incidents where free speech could be, you know, said to have been suppressed on a campus, there have also been a number of cases. Many of those incidents involve people on the left who were silenced or shut down. And you don't hear anything about those cases. And there's a guy named Jeffrey Sachs. He's a poli-sci professor at Acadia University in Canada, put together a database of all the cases where a professor was dismissed for political speech of some form in the United States between 2015 and 2017, and found that left-wing professors were more likely to be dismissed for their speech than conservative ones. So just up front, let's be clear, before we get into this conversation about speech suppression on campuses, that it isn't a huge crisis. There have been very few cases. The majority of the cases involving conservatives have only really revolved around three or four different people. And there's been just as much, if not more, suppression of speech on campus against leftist professors and progressive professors as there has been against conservative professors. But putting that aside, now let's get back into the sort of philosophical and ideological position. And it sort of goes back to something I said before about free speech not entitling you to someone else's platform. Just because Richard Spencer has a right to free speech, and Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos, Ben Shapiro, me, you know, whomever, left or right, who's out there speaking, just because we have the right to free speech doesn't mean that any college is obligated to invite us in. Number one, there's only so many days in the year, right? What is it? Maybe 185 days in a typical college year calendar. There are only so many spaces and venues on a campus for speakers. So by definition, a college can't bring everyone. By definition, a college can't even bring a completely representative sample of the ideas that are out there, because there's more than Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives. There's views on all kinds of issues that span a broad array of beliefs, and no college is going to be able, practically speaking, to provide a platform or a venue for everyone. And when they choose not to provide a platform or venue for everyone, those of us who don't get to come to so-and-so school don't get to whine and moan and complain about it. And even if it's based on the content of our speech, even if it is based on ideology, what of it? What of it? You know, there have been schools that have never invited me. I've been lecturing around the country for 23 years, and I've spoken a lot of places, but there are a lot of places where I have never spoken because those schools are conservative, often religiously affiliated institutions who have a mission and ideology that is counter to my own. BYU has never brought me, for instance. Bob Jones University never brought me. Liberty University's never brought me. Hillsdale has never brought me. You know, lots of schools that have never brought me in to speak. And I know for a fact that it has to do with fundamental ideological disagreements between me and those institutions. And you know what? That's fine. They have a right to have a mission that, frankly, excludes people like me. Would it be great for them to invite me? Yeah, I would love to speak at any of those places. I would love to go and share and interact and discuss issues of race in America with folks at Liberty and with folks at Bob Jones. And I know there are some wonderful students and faculty and staff there with whom I could probably have really good conversations. But if they don't want to bring me, they don't have to bring me. By the same token, if schools don't want to bring Milo and Ben Shapiro and Richard Spencer and Ann Coulter because they feel that their mission is violated by right-wing political beliefs around issues of race and ethnicity, culture, gender, sexuality, they have the right to do that too. Now, I know the rejoinder to this, which is, well, that's fine for private schools, Tim, but it's not okay for public. Public schools should not be able to discriminate in that fashion because they are paid for by all the taxpayers. And so as a result, if you don't allow conservative speakers, you're essentially saying to, you know, roughly half the taxpayers, let's say, to hell with your views. We're going to take your money, but we're not going to represent them. But see, that's not a very persuasive argument for a couple of reasons. Now, number one, look, if a school didn't allow any conservative thought, then yeah, you might have an argument. But to say that they have to bring just whoever's prominent on the right or on the left, for that matter, isn't true. I've had public schools that have extended invitations to me to come speak and then change their mind because somebody hipped them to some social media post, some tweet, Facebook post, or article or speech I'd given where I said something that they found offensive or said something that they thought was, you know, tonally problematic. They didn't like the tone or the approach. They watched a speech and they thought, you know, we don't want that guy. Or they read the tweet and they're like, nah, we don't like the way he expresses this view. They might go out and find someone else who's liberal or progressive on issues of race to bring in, but they decided that they didn't want me to come because of the way that I make the case. And you know what? That's their right, even though it's a public school. And it could very well be that public colleges and universities are looking at people like Ben Shapiro, Ann Coulter, Milo Yiannopoulos, and saying it's not about them being conservative. It's about them being assholes, particularly for Milo and Ann and people like that. And maybe even for Ben. And just like the, you know, I've had a couple schools say that with me, like, no, you know, Tim sort of conducted himself like an asshole last week on Twitter. And so we're going to rescind our invitation. They have the right to do that, even though there are people paying taxes in that state who might have wanted to hear me. Too bad. Secondly, this idea that public institutions can't be choosy because they have to represent everyone, that's not true. Remember the example I used a second ago about the geology department. There are taxpayers, I'm sure, in every state who really believe that the earth is between 6 and 10,000 years old because that's what they believe the Bible says because their pastor told them so, by God. Now, the fact that that is anti-intellectual, pseudoscientific bullshit doesn't change the fact that there are lots of people stupid enough to believe it. And they pay taxes that go to support whatever public college or university is in their state. But they do not have standing legally or morally to then stand up and say, well, by God, I pay taxes for the University of Wyoming and they don't hire anyone who has my views in that department. No, you know, they don't. And they don't have to because they are places of learning and scholarship and they get to discern and discriminate between scholarship and bullshit. They have that right. That is actually their function. It is their purpose. And you don't get to trump that, no pun intended, just because you're a taxpayer. Just like in K-12 schools, and the courts have already ruled on this, you cannot require schools to teach creationism side by side with evolution and science just because 30% or 40%, or even if it was 70% of the public in a given state might believe in creationism. You still don't have to teach that on an equal basis with actual science. In fact, you're obligated not to teach pseudoscience on an equal ground with science. So if colleges and universities are able to discriminate in that way, in terms of who they're going to hire, they don't have to hire flat earthers, they don't have to hire young earthers, they don't have to hire people in the history department who think the Holocaust did not happen, or that the moon landing was fake, Are you saying that they only have the right to be discerning when it comes to faculty hires? Well, why is that? Schools exist for the propagation of scholarship. If the departments are able to discern between actual scholarship and bullshit, why is the larger institution within which those departments exist not able to do the same? Why are they not able to actually say, yeah, you know, Richard Spencer's full of shit based on scholarly standards of interpretation and we ain't gonna host his ass? Same thing with Milo, same thing with Anne, maybe even the same thing with Ben, or if they so choose, they could say the same thing about me and make that case on academic grounds or even more broad than academic, because I realize you're not gonna be able to, you know, academically vet every speaker, nor would you want to. You wouldn't want every speaker, guest lecturer on a campus to be someone who published all their shit in scholarly journals and spoke like a professor. That, you know, that's why we have professors, and that's great. But there are public intellectuals, right, left, and everything else, who people do want to hear from, public figures. I get that. That's valuable. But can the school not discern even among those? Of course they should be able to. And one of the ways I think it seems reasonable to say they should is to go back again to the mission of our institutions of higher learning. What is a typical college's mission? Typically, a college or university has two related missions. One, very simply, is the propagation of and the dissemination, dispensation of knowledge, right? So you gather scholars together and they teach and they propagate knowledge and they research. It is a knowledge-based scholarly institution. And on that grounds, they can obviously discriminate, if you will, between scholarly and non-scholarly opinion. But colleges also have a social function, don't they? Because if they didn't, we would just do all college classes online. You wouldn't have to get together with people. You wouldn't have to live in res halls or actually go into a class and interact with other human beings. You could just sit at your computer and do it all online. To the extent colleges and universities, at least traditional colleges and universities, require campuses that you actually go to for most of your classes and you live there and you spend significant social time there, those institutions are also about creating community, not just dispensing scholarship, but creating community. And if you read the mission statements of most colleges and universities, they'll talk about that, about creating a community of learners. And they'll also talk about things like creating a community of respect. Lifelong learning in a global environment is a very common cliche. You'll hear talk of pluralism and diversity and respect, mutual respect. These are principles that colleges and universities adhere to almost uniformly. They claim to be about that. And those are mission statements that are almost by definition sort of liberal. And if I have a mission statement that talks about pluralism and diversity and respect and lifelong learning in a global environment, and if I'm a public institution, the purpose of which is intrinsically community-based, it's about serving the public, and that public is becoming increasingly of color, increasingly including working-class people, people from different cultural, ethnic, and religious backgrounds, people from around the world who come to the United States, then those public institutions have to be responsive to that public, which is increasingly not white, increasingly not male, increasingly not rich, increasingly not just Christian. So you can sit there and say, well, these taxpayers who are conservative are being shut out in public institutions, but the public mission of public institutions is by definition a more liberal mission. It's a more inclusive mission. It's a mission that is about creating equal protection, equity of access. And if reactionary viewpoints that are demeaning to people of color, demeaning to LGBT folk, demeaning to women as women, demeaning to Muslims, violate the ability of students who fall into those categories to receive an education on equal terms at a state institution with other students, then what you're saying is that the free speech rights of racist and sexist and misogynist and homophobes and Islamophobes is actually more important than the 14th Amendment equal protection rights of people of color, women of all colors, Muslims, Jews, etc. And that's just an absurdity. You have to try to balance these things out. And so I do think it's important that we have a multiplicity and a variety of viewpoints, but I also think that schools ought to be able to exercise their freedom of speech and freedom of association and say, here's our mission, here's our vision and values, and if your viewpoints fundamentally violate our core principles, we don't have to bring you. And there is no private or public distinction, because those public institutions still have a right to discriminate in who's going to be hired in those departments, even if that shuts out right-wing creationists. Public institutions, most of them are not open access to everybody who wants to come. You still got to meet certain academic standards. So if a state institution is able to say to a taxpayer, hey, your kid isn't academically qualified to come here, sorry, if a public institution can distinguish on the basis of academic merit and say, you are not qualified to come, you do not fit in because you don't meet these standards, why can't a public institution say to the very same taxpayers, your kid can't come because they don't fit in with our mission and our values? Institutions, colleges and universities have to have the right to uphold their vision and values, their missions. And to say that they don't is to say that they don't have the right to speak. That Richard Spencer's rights to free speech outweigh the rights of a college or university to speak with one voice about what they believe. And that seems like an absurdity to me. If companies have the right, if corporations, profit or nonprofit, have the right to speak, then they have the right to speak. And if I'm going to come to a campus and say, well, because certain people at this campus feel differently, therefore you have to accommodate our views, I don't understand really why that is. Does BYU really have to accommodate the views of people who reject Mormonism? Do they? I don't think they do. They have a right to their vision and values and their mission statement, the right to live it. I don't think that non-Mormons have the right to go in there and demand that they give equal time to people who think, for instance, that Mormonism is a cult. I don't think they have to do that. I'm not saying Mormonism is a cult. Please don't say that's what I'm saying. I'm just saying it. There are people who say that. You know, does BYU have to accommodate that? I don't think so. Now, you might argue, well, it's different if it's a state institution, but, you know, is it? Do state institutions not have the right to have certain visions and values and missions? You know, we have this recent Supreme Court case that just came down regarding the guy who sued because he didn't want to be a member of the public sector union. What was it, Illinois or Wisconsin? You know, the case, it just came down. This is a guy who didn't want to be a member of the public sector union because he felt that the public sector, the government union in question was either mismanaging money or it was just too expensive. The state couldn't afford the pension plan or whatever, and he wanted the right not to join. He was compelled under state law as a state employee to be a member of the union. And of course, the argument the union made was, look, we represent you in collective bargaining. If we're going to represent you, we have the right to collect dues from you because otherwise you're free riding on that. Well, the Supreme Court basically rejected that and said, no, you don't have to join the union because to make you join the union is to compel your speech in the direction that the union wants because the union's a lobbying organization. They lobby for certain things. This guy was saying, I don't agree with these things. Therefore, I don't want to be a member of the union. Very important. The Supreme Court agreed with him, but they did not say to him, oh, you can join the union and not pay dues, right? No, if you join the union, you got to pay dues. But they were saying, no, you don't have to be a member of the union because they are speaking in a way that you do not approve of. Well, the logical corollary here is that if you become a member, and this is public, remember, it's a public union, so apply that to a public university. If you go to a public university and you don't like the fact that they have a particular set of positions, vision, value, mission statements, there might very well be people, for instance, at the University of Tennessee, just to use that example since that's where I live, who think that the University of Tennessee's lobbying for certain things, you know, from the state legislature is wrong-headed because the state doesn't have the money for this, that, and the other thing. They may believe, you know, all kinds of, they just don't like the vision and values. They don't like the diversity efforts of the university. They don't like the fact that there's a LGBT student center or organization or whatever it is. But here's the thing. You don't have to be a member of the University of Tennessee any more than you have to be a member of that union. So if you don't want to be a member, you don't have to be. But the union has a right to lobby as they see fit and have their vision as they see fit. The university, even a public one, has the right to do the same. And to say that they don't, to say that the public university ought to have to accommodate all views because it's public, would be like saying that the public union, that guy that sued them, instead of saying that he doesn't have to join, what if the court had said, well, no, you have to join, but then the union has to lobby for your position too. So they have to go to Springfield, Illinois, and go for the legislature and argue both sides of that issue about the pensions. You know, that the union itself has to somehow balance out its own views. No, that's not what the court said, and that would have been ridiculous. The court said the union has a right to its views. You have the right to your views. If you don't like the union's views, don't join the union. Cool. Apply that argument to the college or university, once again, public, and the corollary is you don't have to join the university. And if you don't like it, you can go elsewhere. So let's not get distracted. This is not fundamentally about free speech. Free speech does not entitle you to a microphone. It does not obligate me to provide you with one. It does not place upon me a responsibility to help you get heard. Your right to speak does not give you a right to my ears. Bottom line, if truth has a liberal bias, if facts and science and social science have a liberal bias, if scholarship has a liberal bias, and if modern conservatism in its tone and its style and approach fundamentally violates violates the mission and the vision and value statements of institutions of higher education in this country, well, then that's not the problem of those of us who believe in those missions. That's the problem of people on the right. So conservatives, you have a choice. You can do real scholarship, which plenty of conservatives do all the time, and you can present that on a campus either as a scholar in residence, i.e. a faculty member, or as a guest lecturer, or you can continue down this path that modern conservatism has taken, which is trolling for trolling's sake, trying to trigger liberals just for the shits and giggles of it, and because it makes certain people upset. That's what Milo does. That's what Ann Coulter does. If you're trolling for trolling's sake, doing polemic for the sake of polemic, that is not scholarship, and a scholarly institution does not owe you the time of day to come and do that crap. And by the same logic, if your approach violates, if your tone and your style of presentation violates the mission the institution has set forward, their vision and their values about creating community, they are no more duty-bound to bring you than a church is to give space to someone to stand up and say God doesn't exist. Institutions have a right to their vision, their values, their beliefs. You have a right to your vision, your values, and your beliefs. And if it just so happens that higher educational institutions, because of their commitment to scholarship and community, have rendered you anachronistic in the modern world, start your own colleges, start your own universities, all of your run to Hillsdale and Bob Jones University and Liberty University, and knock yourselves out. But leave the rest of us alone, because we have a nation to build and a world to save from the likes of you. And that'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Join us again next week and every Tuesday, and you can also check out my essays at medium.com or my website, www.timwise.org, and follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram. Take care, and stop by again next week. And the righteous.